You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cactus Cafe. And thank you so much for bearing with us for our little technical difficulties as we waited for things to kind of get set up. So thank you. And it's kind of appropriate for us to be running a little bit late and talking about motherhood, because motherhood and having a child completely reframes the way you think about time in general. So we're here tonight to talk about something which is, it's an interesting thing to discuss, but a very significant topic, because we're in Texas and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. We're talking about supporting mothers and babies and what meaningful support looks like and why it's particularly important to support women of color during this transitional time. Here with me to talk about this, Ashley Lopez. Ashley covers politics and healthcare for KUT and for NPR, and she continues to do really meaningful and powerful work on women's health and reproductive care in Texas, and is part of the NPR Kaiser Health News Reporting Collaborative. Welcome, Ashley Lopez.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ashley. We can just... It's a big deal to bring everybody together, so we got to acknowledge that. Also, we have Trishelle Treese. Trishelle is currently the birth support director with Mama Sana, Vibrant Woman. She aims to, quote, inspire more black and brown women to become birth companions so that more women in our community are supported, educated, and protected throughout their birth experience. Welcome, Trishelle Treese.
Glad to be here.
Nicole Mills is the owner of Deep Root Doula Service, and in order to offer more support to mamas and babies, has studied Rebozo, is that pronounced correctly? Rebozo Techniques, Principles of Lactation Management, the HypnoBabies Program, and IPEC Core Energy Coaching. Welcome, Nicole, and thank you
for
joining
having
us.
Me.
And finally, Linnell Kultas is a doula and doula mentor, breastfeeding counselor, certified birthing from within mentor and advisor. And this is my favorite part, because she has twice held me through this journey. Linnell has been compassionately ferrying parents across unknown waters since 1995. And when I say held me, I mean you ferried me and my family across those waters. So,
so happy to be
welcome,
here.
Welcome, Linnell. So let's see. Ashley, why don't we start with you? Because we're talking about this in Texas. Why is it so important to speak about this in Texas at this particular moment? What is the data showing? Where are we at? Kind of frame this discussion for us.
Yeah. I mean, unlike a lot of states, we actually have a lot of births. A lot of states around the country actually have declining population rates. A lot of that is because a lot of people aren't having babies. But Texas has a good economy. We have a lot of people moving in here, not just immigrants, but people from, you know, other states, other parts of the state. So Texas has like something like 500,000 babies are born every year here. Like, we have a lot of babies. A lot of people are becoming parents. And, you know, that's a whole new population that Texas, you know, has to find a way to, like, you know, serve. And so that's a really important piece of our population. When we think of like a booming population in Texas, everyone's always like, oh, people are moving here for jobs. No, also a lot of people, half of that is people are having babies, unlike a lot of states. So that's really important, one, just because that's a big part of like the Texas story. And two, we're not doing a good job. Like, data shows that we have a really, well, we have bad data, that's one problem, but the data that we do have shows that we have a lot of mothers struggling, either having what we call, you know, maternal morbidity rates are pretty high. That means that women aren't dying, but getting close to dying while giving birth, and that has its own set of, you know, health problems, and it's its own public health issue. And then we also have a lot of women who are dying while giving birth, which is, you know, a thing that other countries have figured out how to prevent. So we have a lot of babies here, a lot of people having babies, and we haven't really figured out a way to do that safely. And then there's the other picture, which is like, you know, outcomes for babies here in Texas compared to a lot of other parts of this country are not good. And I'm talking about health and well-being, sort of socioeconomic stuff. Like, we are, Texas, by a lot of measures, is sort of underperforming when it comes to serving people who are having babies and then the babies once they're here, in a nutshell. It's not very pretty, but it's not like a fun story, but I mean, it just shows that there's like a lot of work that needs to be done here.
And where are we as far as data? What is the maternal mortality rate in Texas?
That's a hard thing to, there's like every study comes up with like new numbers because like we don't actually track deaths well in Texas. A lot of that is like, so in, for example, I'm from Florida. Florida has, like, every region of the state has a medical examiner. So if you die, someone's going to figure out what caused that. And it's a professional. Here, like, I mean, a good example is what happened. Does everyone remember when Justice Scalia died? It was, like, this big, it actually caused a lot of, like, weird conspiracy theories because no one was there to, like, go to the body and, like, a forensic specialist or a medical examiner wasn't there really to get the body or figure out what happened because he was in a rural part of Texas. So people, when they die in rural parts of the state, like there's not really a professional to like figure out what happened. So like death records aren't accurate all the time or consistent. So from what we know, we are on par with some third world countries, but I don't trust that data as much. But what I do know is that from what the data we do have, like, it's not a good picture. Like even if that, if the metrics are off just a little bit, we have a lot of room to improve. But what we do have better records of is morbidity, because that happens usually in hospitals, like women who almost die, while giving birth, and those numbers are also pretty bad. And it depends where you live. A lot of it, it depends where you live, but mostly like rural parts of the state, obviously, where like they don't have continued access to like a OBGYN. That kind of thing.
And Linnell, you have been on the front lines in Austin for quite a while, over 20 years. Does this sound like something that you have come in contact with, these types of experiences with women? I mean, what have you witnessed over the years?
I have, in my experience, never had a mother die. And so this talk about maternal morbidity, maternal mortality, is somewhat out of reach for me. But I definitely work with mothers that are struggling for a variety of reasons on the other side of giving birth. So, we need to do a lot better. There's a lot more that we could do. And it's not hard stuff. It's really super easy. It is heart and hands kind of stuff. It doesn't take a medical degree even to fix the problem.
Yeah. And Trishelle, you got involved in your doula services because of trauma. Talk a little bit about your experience and why you got involved in becoming a doula.
Yeah, definitely. Just to piggyback off of what Ashley was saying, it's not only that the women are dying during childbirth, but they're dying within the first year of childbirth as well. So it seems like to me, from my experience, that a lot of women, and this is just coming from the women I've been working with, women of color, that the stress load after they're having babies is just too much for them to handle. They are not getting enough downtime to heal. They're going right back into their stressful life that they were in before they delivered, and it's just having a bad outcome for the baby and also the women. And that's the reason why I got into this, because my personal experience was the same way. Right when I went to, you know, had my babies, I had to go right back home and go back to work, and I didn't really have a lot of downtime. I didn't have my mom there because I was in another city, and so I was like, you know, I don't want any of the women to have to go through this. I'm going to step into this role so I can fill that gap or fill that void that we're having amongst the Black community, Black and brown. Mm-hmm.
And how about you? I mean, Nicole, how did you get into everything? What was your experience around childbirth, and why did you want to help women of color?
So for me, I had an experience that I think is not uncommon now when we have, dispersed families. I was giving birth in Los Angeles, and my entire support system was on the East Coast where I grew up. And so I didn't have access to the type of pregnancy and labor experience that's common in my family, where there is a network of women, multi-generational. We have traditions in our family about how you get taken care of when you're pregnant and after. I didn't have that. So when I became aware of what a doula is and that they were available in my community, I sought out somebody because I needed that female wisdom. I needed that knowledge and support about childbirth and labor and the postpartum period from someone else. And I knew that that burden, I don't want to call it a burden, but that role didn't need to fall to my partner at that time. You know, I had two stepchildren who were 2 and 3 at the time. Mm-hmm. So he was very much concerned about, you know, keeping the other two, you know, off the roof and that kind of thing. And so I knew that I needed somebody who could be focused on care for me and to answer my questions in a way that I didn't think was going to be accessible through my OB. And I lucked out in that I had an OB who had a practice with midwives. The midwives, you know, spent a lot more time with me than is common during visits. But still, you know, the person who in the middle of the night or late afternoon, you know, who would come and sit with me, answer my questions, who was going to be there continuously, you know, through, you know, my birth experience, was going to be my doula. My partner was there, but was asleep through most of the time. So the person who was going to be awake and alert and tuned into me and where I was at, that was my doula. And so having had that experience, I wanted to be able to share that. I wanted more women, you know, my community to be aware of it and to have access to it. Because when I explained to people that I'd had a doula, and this was 12 years ago, a lot of people were like, well, what is that? Is that, you know, a birth coach? You know, those are the people who tell you when to breathe and all that. And I was like, it's just a whole nother experience beyond that. And I knew how I benefited from it. Unfortunately, when I moved to Austin, I found that Austin is honestly an oasis in Texas for birth services. And we have several nonprofits, but one that I got involved with was Giving Austin Labor Support. So this was a way for me, after I got my training through DONA, which is a certifying organization for doulas in North America, after I got my training, GALS was an opportunity for me to volunteer, offer doula services as it fit my schedule. So I could go on call when I could make it. And GALS has different programs. I would volunteer with a program that also offers prenatal visits through any baby can. So that's really how I got into it. And then as I began to do the work and learn more, I learned just how critical the situation was for Black women in the U.S. So in case everybody's not aware, a Black woman in the United States is 3 to 4 times more likely to die as a result of having given birth within a year of giving birth than her white counterparts. We are all still failing white women also. So it's not that, you know, our white sisters are having amazing outcomes nationwide. They're also suffering and struggling too. But the problem is very acute with Black women. So if we can crack, you know, the code on saving, serving, and preserving the lives of Black women, we will raise the water level for all women in the U.S. And so as I began to do the advocacy work and just talking to people in my peer group, I just realized that I needed other platforms that were going to help me, you know, do more of the work. And so that's one of the reasons why I joined the board of directors of Healing Hands Community Doula Project. We're focused on, you know, how can we, you know, turn the tide on, you know, practices and service rendered to Black women in the Central Texas area. So I said a lot. Feel free to, you know, jump in
I just wanted to jump in and say something. And you might know about the Black paper that was just published. I love that they called it the Black paper, not a white paper. It was the Black paper. But they found that immigrant Black mothers who come to this country and give birth have better outcomes than native Black women that are here. But over time,
That evaporates.
And it's something about the lived experience here in America that causes the weathering, even for immigrant mothers who were not born here.
Yeah. That's something that the AFIA Center said. Like, I'll never forget this conversation. It was like a panel just like this. And this is something when I was reporting on maternal mortality that really stuck in my mind, which is like, why are these outcomes so bad for Black women, but yet, you know, Hispanic women, their outcomes were actually better than white women. They were outperforming everyone. And I remember a woman on the panel said, just give them time. Like, let Hispanic women under, you know, this kind of environment have babies for generations, and then we'll we can really truly compare the two things. And a lot of that is lived experience. Like, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, considering what's going on in the world right now in this country specifically, like, I would love to see longitudinal studies of like what it's like for babies growing up in an environment like this if their last name is something like Garcia, right? Like, who knows what those health outcomes are like, because lived experience, like everyone across the board says, like, those are the things that really affect public health in the long term, and like when we talk about things like this. So yeah, I mean, I've heard that many times, but other than that, I haven't seen research about like why exactly that is. It's just like some people are like, it's obvious if you think about
it. I feel like it's the culture. I feel like it's the culture, because I've been being a doula. I had a private practice, and of course I've worked with all kind of women, but when I work with women that's in poverty, and especially Black women that come from Black culture, and they feel like they're not, I don't know how to say it, but like they feel like they're not educated, so they don't feel like they deserve an explanation for things. And that kind of makes Black women like, okay, feel some type of way. I don't feel safe in this place. This person's not even talking to me, you know? They're not explaining things to me. And so what happens then? We as doulas know that if the mom is not totally relaxed, she tenses up, that causes complications. We need the mom to be totally relaxed in a serene environment for the baby to come, you know, in good circumstances. So I just feel like it's the culture. They don't understand the culture. They don't understand the struggle. So they kind of treat us a certain way. I was also in a birth one time. It was actually my sister's birth. She was having twins, and the twins was coming a little bit earlier than they should. And the nurse came in. It was a white nurse. She said, told my sister, she was like, well, if the babies have to go to the NICU, it'll probably be all right, because Black African-American babies are a little bit more feistier, so they'll probably won't be in there long. And we kind of all just looked at each other like, well, what is that supposed to mean, you know?
I have heard this so much, and there's actually a NICU saying that the white boys do the worst, and they're actually called wimpy white boys. And I've heard NICU nurses refer to them as that. So you're right about the culture. It's it's so sticky. If you hear your mentor refer to a patient that way, and that's how everybody else refers to the patient, it sticks, and it just goes and goes and goes until somebody brings it to the light and says, wait a second. Why are we labeling human beings? Why are we doing... From the get-go.
Right.
From out the womb.
Right. Right.
From out of the womb. And also just the way in which pain is understood. I mean, I have heard anecdotal stories about Black women not being given any type of pain medication because there's an understanding like, well, they can endure it. I mean, those are really toxic, very troubling, and disturbing ideas about how people go into birth.
And we were talking about the roots of that are in modern gynecology.
Yeah, the father of gynecology.
Because Black women were practiced on, and that is probably where this idea that Black women can tolerate more pain came from.
Right. They said that the father of gynecology said that the Black enslaved women didn't need anesthesia because they were able to endure more pain than their white counterparts. So, and all around, and I feel like in this society, period, that Black women are treated more aggressively, we're approached more aggressively, we're more masculated in this country than our white sisters. So, yeah, I totally feel you on that.
Yeah, and there's definitely documentation around Blacks in general not having the same access to pain procedures and medications, because there's the bias and the disbelief that, you know, we are playing up our pain to get access to, you know, opioids and narcotics and things like that. And so there's a level of disbelief. You know, a patient should not have to convince you that their pain is at a 10. You have a scale on the wall. You've been into a hospital that says, you know, is your pain at a 1 or a 10? You know? So if you're saying tell me where you're at. And then they're saying, I'm at a 9, I'm at a 10. It's not for you to say, no, actually, you're at a 5, and you can just take, you know, Tylenol, and you'll be fine with it. And so it's negating, you know, the patient's ability to assess where they are. This happens a lot, you know, in birth and postpartum. A woman is listening to her body. She's giving feedback about what is going on with her, and then she's not being respected and listened to. So I'll give you an anecdote from my personal experience. I have a best friend who always has high-risk pregnancies because of, you know, just genetic issues. So knowing this, her last pregnancy with twins, I was on the phone with her, and she was complaining to me about how swollen her feet were and how her ankles looked like balloons, and she'd had this headache that she couldn't get rid of. And I said, call me and tell me what they say from the ER. And she was like, well, I have an appointment. I said, get off the phone with me now. I'm going to hang up on you. You call me from the ER. She did not call me back from the ER that night because she was admitted and her children were delivered within a couple hours of her arriving at the hospital. Now, what she had told me, so basically, as we recognize, this is a preeclampsia situation, and there were a couple other things going on, but, you know, her main issue was that it was preeclampsia, which can end your life, and the children have to be delivered, and there are things that have to be done in order to help you right your body if that's caught in time. If it's not, you know, that can play into our maternal morbidity and mortality rates. So this is someone who is having the last of her 5 children. This is not her first pregnancy. When she tells you, you know, what she's going through, why would you not believe her? But she had had several ER visits over the course of that week. The last time she'd gone in, the charge nurse said, you again. What are you in here for this time? And so she felt defensive, and she said, listen, you know, my OB said that if the following things are happening, I just have to come in. You know, I can't wait for an office visit. So she was on the phone with me describing things that really should have just, again, they met her doctor's checklist of if any of these things happen, go to the ER. But she felt reluctant because she started doubting herself. She doubted what she knew about her own body based on the negative experience that she'd had. And so a lot of us can, you know, judge and say, oh, well, no, I would never have taken that, you know, I would have always advocated. But think in terms of how tired you are, how worn down you are, how scared you might be. There are a lot of other factors that someone else's doubt can get into your head, and it feeds your own doubt. And so that's the last thing that we need to have happen. We need women to feel free about sharing what's going on with them, and they need to have access to a care system that's going to follow up on that. One of the things that is a huge problem in Texas, we have to think about, Texas is massive, and we have a concentration of all these wonderful services here in Austin. Think about when you are in more far-flung counties from Travis County. Is there a maternity ward in your county at all? So we take for granted, because in our city, we have several hospitals that have excellent services. We can go to birthing centers. We have midwives who do home births. We have a plethora of services. If you imagine giving birth, going into labor, and you are in a county where you have to leave your county in order to have your baby in a maternity ward, or your alternative is going to a hospital where who knows who's going to be there for you and how many babies they deliver and what resources do they have. Do they have crash carts that are set up for, you know, hemorrhages and things like that after birth? Then fast forward, you've had this baby. You have certain visits that are set up. They're on your calendar. It takes a lot of doing for you to carve out the time in your schedule to get to that doctor in another county. Are you going to run a county or two over every time you feel something that is not quite right? So think of, and then add on, there are co-pays, there's gas, maybe you have other children, you got to find somebody to take care of them while you're at a visit, because a lot of people don't know, little babies toddlers can't sit there as you're having a pelvic exam and you're OBs, you know, and some OBs will not let them sit in, you know, the lobby without someone with them. So there's a web of services and there's a web of things that women need to even be able to speak up and address what's going on with them. And then they need reception and positivity on the other side, and they need respect in order for their needs to get met. We have a lot of holes in that whole system.
Yeah, and all of those holes, I mean, these are some of the things that I'd like to address tonight. Like, there is a huge problem, right? There's the culture, and as you mentioned, Ashley, like, oh, just give them time to be in the United States. What is it about the United States? I mean, why? Why are we failing women and babies so badly? And so maybe just each of you, what can really help? Like, from your experience, what can we do now?
I feel like having extra training for medical staff on being culturally aware and also trauma-informed trainings as well, that would probably help out.
Talk about that. Talk about trauma-informed. What do you mean when you say that?
Just kind of knowing, like, that these women are going through a lot, especially the immigrants that's coming in now. They have gone through a lot to get here. They are in these situations with their families. Just kind of knowing their situation and knowing that they're coming into the birth already with a lot of anxiety. So really giving that bedside manner, I don't see that anymore in the hospitals. Bedside manner just don't exist no more. Sometimes they don't even get to meet their doctors. And so it's just a lot of restructuring the medical staff and institutions that need to happen before we can even move forward.
Anil or Ashley, what?
Well, I guess, like, from a policy perspective, I think a lot of it is, like, philosophical in the United States. Like, we're a very individualistic country, and we approach our healthcare policy that way. What I mean by that is, like, you know, families and individuals are seen as sort of insular and not other people's problems. When, like, the idea of, like, you know, I always think of, like, Hillary Clinton's, like, it takes a village. Like, that's what giving birth and having families always was. It was never, like, you're insular, like, just your nuclear family and just you. Like, that's usually the way that the world, like, historically we've seen raising children. But that's not the way, that's not the ethos of this country. And a lot of that, I don't know if it's like the chicken and the egg is like our philosophy and our policy. I don't know which one it is. But we do definitely approach families that way. Like, that's why we don't have, like, I mean, we haven't had like a real discussion on childcare policy yet. That's why, like, a good example here in Texas is, like, and I mean nationally, we were supposed to, like, I remember when, you know, Trump was elected, there was supposed to be this, like, resurgence of, like, let's talk about childcare and, like, making sure that it was easier for new moms to have some, like, to have available, like, have access to appropriate childcare. And here in Texas, like, a good example is, like, our healthcare policies, like, when it comes to, like, Medicaid, for example, like, I don't know if people know this, but, like, 2 months after you give birth, you lose your Medicaid, like, if you were on Medicaid when you had a baby, like, that is really soon. Like, that's why, like, we're not really catching a lot of these healthcare problems a year after someone's gives birth, because a lot of these women don't have access to proper healthcare in that time. And it's like, and there was an opportunity actually this January, like this past legislative session, to address an issue that was that small, and it never happened, because it's like, it's really hard to convey to, like, policymakers and the people who kind of make decisions, like, actually, like, we should be providing care for people that are outside our family. I just feel like it's philosophical. Like, we're very, like, especially in Texas, it's very, like, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. When, like, especially, like, it just seems to me, like, and I will say, as, like, probably the only person who's never had a baby up here, like, it seems to me from the outside, like, raising families and having babies is not meant to be solitary. Like, it is a lot of work. And so we just don't view our policies that way. And so from the very beginning, in terms of just getting sort of basic care, we don't approach raising babies that way. And so I think that's, like, the top line. And sorry, that's, like, a kind of, like, umbrella type problem to address.
So addressing why should we care? Why should we care at all that mothers are dying? Why should we care that the support is so crappy? And you're saying we should care, even though it's not us, we should care.
And why, I mean, Linnell, you have mentioned you start at mothers and babies and you heal the wounds of the world. You know? I mean, you've said that, and tell me where that comes from. How do you come to that wisdom?
I looked that up to try to figure out who was it that said a society that raises up mothers and babies succeeds. When we put mothers and babies on a pedestal, when we really cherish them and care for them and love on them, that when a mother has that platform, she doesn't just swallow that up. She gives and gives and gives and gives back if she's been given to. So from my perspective, and I didn't come up with this, but I heard it somewhere, we can do so much better as a society if we raise up mothers and babies. We just have to care. We have to care that they matter, and start making policy around that. Also, from my perspective, the quickest, probably easiest thing we could implement is more doulas, more doula programs. Doulas are the key, and the story that you shared is just classic. It's a classic, you know, the doula is the person that can hear those things and say, something's not quite right. Please call your care provider. This is really serious. Please call your care provider right now. And so in a lot of ways, the doula can be that bridge, and not giving medical advice, but can be a bridge to getting the mother better care.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is a perception shift that we really need to get to in this country is that we need to stop thinking of doula care as a luxury. Yes. And it breaks my heart when I have clients who, I would love to see them have a birth doula and a postpartum doula, right? But if you can afford to have a doula at all, often you're making a choice between either or. And I want you to have both. And that's the perception shift that I want us to get away, you know, to get into. I think it's entirely possible that, I'll say this, there are things that we can all do. There are resources that allow all of us to get educated about what kind of postpartum support women tend to need. We can all organize care calendars for people in our families and our communities who have had children. You can't organize it on the mother. You know, you definitely have to, you know, work with her on that. But the idea is that, you know, think in terms of how many people do you know who've had children, and are you at all aware of how they got their needs met in the first 12 weeks after they had the baby? You know, how did the laundry get done? Who watched the other kids? How did they get back and forth to their different appointments? Who cleaned the house? You know, who walked the dog? And these seem like small things, but they make a huge impact. How educated are you about the signs of postpartum depression? You know, would you be able to visit a friend, you know, a few times a week and notice different shifts and changes that you might want to raise to them or somebody who can help them get care? So these are things that we can get educated about. We can ask for, you know, improved sex education, you know, for our kids. We talk about how babies get made, but we don't talk about how babies get out, and we don't talk about what happens to the person who's holding and carrying that child, and what the baby and the mothers need in the aftermath. We don't pre-wire partners to know, here's what's going to change with you, you know. You will have physical demands that, you know, you might not expect. Everybody's losing sleep when there's a baby in the house, you know. So, but we can do a better job about educating boys and girls at a young age about this is the full spectrum of what this experience looks like. It's not just, you know, the miracle of life and, you know, that's the end of the story. So these are, you know, concrete things. We can have different conversations. We can, share education, make requests for, you know, how we want kids to be taught. And then, you know, honestly, I like I said, you know, we need to press for the idea that, you know, this type of care is not a luxury. It should be table stakes. if we need to press legislators, you know, to fund that, then that's what we need to change our priorities of what we ask to get paid for. There are European countries where it is common that you go home with a baby box, right? It doesn't matter what your social economic status is. Everybody loves to get this box. It's a little cardboard box. It's got, you know, the same, everybody gets the same things, but you get the same box that your mother got, that your grandmother got, you know, and they cherish that. I wish that we had nationwide a similar standard where you go home with a kit that has, you know, nutritional vouchers if you need it, that has, you know, maybe coupons for sending your laundry out or whatever it might be. I wish that we had a better care package that went out of the hospital. You have a baby in the United States today, you can go home with all kinds of formula samples and brochures for stuff that you don't need and probably are not going to buy. But is there in that, you know, packet that you are sent home with tools that are going to help you rest, nourish yourself? You know, a healthy mother with a strong body who has rested is in a better position to care for, you know, her newborn and to rebound and be strong in that first year. So these are the kind of things that I think in terms of we don't need anybody's permission to push for these things.
Yeah, and there's so much, I mean, in just what you said, there's so much that comes into a juxtaposition. Like, you don't need to send them home with all of these things that they can buy. You know, I mean, it's like, right. And I feel like coming into contact with this giant capitalist society where it's like you can buy your way out of XYZ, you know, I found that to be something really pressing. Just when I had my son, like, there was no support for breastfeeding. There was no, you know, help with what that was. But I sure did have a lot of samples of formula to just go to, you know, right away. And it's like those clashes between what is important to our society for, you know, the marketplace and then what's important to mothers that's completely outside of the marketplace. Like, how do you maintain a rhetoric around what's valuable to sustain life outside of the marketplace?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that point about doula services not being a luxury. That's why I take this role that at Mama Sauna Robin Woman so serious as the birth support director. These women are getting, and this is all free to them. They come in and have a space for them to have postpartum circles. We are educating them, and then they move into our doula program, which is they're working with them. They have a doula for the labor and also do our postpartum for 6 weeks. They get 6 visits, and we're coming into their home for 2 hours, making sure that they don't have to lift a finger, pretty much. And then if they do need meals, we set up meal trains with the women that have already had babies in our program, and they still want to help out, but they can't give that all of that service.
That's a classic example of when you feed a mother, mm-hmm. she will pay it forward, she will keep giving.
Right, and so they're like, okay, I want to help out, but I really can't because I still have this small baby, so I'll just set up a meal train. Hey, this mom needs somebody to cook for her, you know, right when she gets home, so they're dropping off food and stuff like that, and we're setting up transportation, and I just love the whole cycle of it. It's just like you come through the program, and then, but you're still helping out, you know?
Talk a little bit about how Mama Sauna got started.
It was kind of like a collective of women. They knew that before all the statistics came out about, not, you know, infant mortality, maternal mortality, they just knew that these women in Austin, Black women, women of color, wasn't being treated right, and they wanted to do something about it. So they kind of just started with doula services, having these circles, educating, and it kind of grew from there. They started going to legislative, you know, advocating for these things, and then that's when they started to get funding, and now they was able to expand on the programs and offer more services to these women. Is just continuing to grow. And when I first got into it, I was a volunteer. I would volunteer my yoga services because I also teach yoga. And I just love the environment. It's such a family environment, family-oriented place. And it was so welcoming. And now it's just taken off. Mm-hmm.
And Ashley, what have you seen really works as far as supporting mamas and babies legislatively?
Yeah, I mean, well, I look a lot at maternal mortality. And again, like, that's just like the tip of the iceberg. That's when everything has failed. You know, and I always, like, I did some reporting on California, actually did a really good job of cutting it, their maternal mortality rate in half. And they did that by a lot of things. First of all, the whole state, like, created a task force. They put a lot of money, like, the state put money into figuring out what was going on and then coming up with ways to fix it. It was really like a collective effort in California to fix this problem. I will say, even though they cut their maternal mortality rate in half, they did not close the race gap that we talked about before. That's still not something they have learned how to fix. So that's not a model that, you know, Texas can extrapolate from. And in some ways, you know, like hospitals came up with ways, like, basically, like, having, like, a manual, like, you know, when a pilot lands a plane, they have, like, a checklist of things to do when things go wrong, like, creating those for, like, preeclampsia, you know, hemorrhaging, stuff like that in a hospital. That has proven to be really good because, like, you don't have a bunch of people not on the same page having different sort of biases in the room dealing with a situation. It's just, like, this is what we do. That has been, and actually Texas has implemented some of that. It's the Texas AIM program. I don't really have a lot of data yet. I've been asking about, like, how that's been working, but, you know, I'll have to, like, badger HHSC for that later. But that's something that has worked in California. And here's a big one. Actually, when you were asking about, like why the U.S. is doing so badly at this, like, the elephant in the room, like, the why we don't have baby boxes and why California did better is because they have expanded Medicaid and other countries have universal health care.
Right. Right. We do everything so state by state. Our data is not collected in the same way state by state. We don't have national standards that have to be adhered to in terms of reporting. You know, some states are asking when a woman has died, have you given birth in the past 12 months? Other states are not. That variance makes it very difficult to spot trends and then to establish best practices.
Yeah, it's hard to tackle a problem when every state is, when you have 50 states. I mean, and then think about Texas, you have 254 counties. Like, we could not be more disjointed. And collective effort, first of all, you need to feel like it's a huge problem. And if in Austin, every 2 years, people are like, women are dying and not a lot changes, that means there's really not enough political will and there's not enough of a concern to make that collective effort. So, I mean, Texas does have a lot they could learn from other countries and just from California, another state in this country. And by the way, California is bigger than us. It's just as diverse or more. So, like, you know, Texas really has no excuse, but, you know, what's lacking here is political will and the fact that, you know, there's not expanded healthcare coverage. That makes it harder. And, you know, I don't know, universal healthcare in countries just, like, universalizes everything. Like, it just makes it all really uniform. So it makes it easier to tackle problems when everybody's on the same page. Now, I'm not saying that will fix everything, but it has shown that, like, it's easier to tackle bigger problems when you have bigger, like, I guess, organizations tackling those problems, like NHS, for example.
But even in the UK, where they have nationalized healthcare, their maternal mortality rate for women of color is still five times greater than white women. So, I mean, there are still these huge gaps, even when we do have the data.
But I will say for the UK, their overall maternal mortality rate is far better than the US's rate. So what's happening is that they are getting more things right than we are in aggregate, but there is still you know, there's systemic racism there. There's inequality there that changes access. Well, I won't say access to care. The care that you get when you show up. So they all have access to care, but they don't all have access to the same care.
Quality care.
Right.
And also how healthy you are before you get pregnant makes a big difference. Like, if you are not going to the doctor 5 months before you get pregnant and you're pregnant and you have a chronic disease that you didn't know about before you went for your first prenatal visit, like, that's not helpful.
Yeah, I do want to say, though, because sometimes this is a stick that black women in this country get beat with, you know, oh, well, you know, a lot of you are older when you go to have a baby. A lot of you are obese or overweight when you go to have a baby. You are predisposed to diabetes and hypertension because of your genetics. What we really need to make sure that we also have on the table when we say these things is that your outcomes don't get better as a Black woman if you are educated, if you are affluent, if you have access to high-quality private health insurance. It doesn't matter if you're athletic and fit. It doesn't matter if you don't have diabetes or hypertension. It doesn't matter if you develop gestational diabetes. None of us get better outcomes. I would love to...
Example is Serena Williams.
Yeah, there's nothing that insulates us. With other populations in this country, there are certain things that get you better results. And this is part of why white women in California are able to capitalize on some of the improvements, right? They're getting access to some of these other things, and then, you know, they get certain boosts. Those boosts, they're not applying to us. So what we need to look at is, well, what's that equalizing factor? What's wiping out the gains for Black women?
Yes. Well, let's open things up to questions. We have about 15 minutes for questions. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. And Amy will come around. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you all for being here tonight. I learned a whole lot. I have a question in 2019, and as we move forward in the 21st century and move forward socially, the idea that it's not just cis women having children. And I'm curious whether you've had these experiences firsthand or just in your own professional communities, and Ashley with healthcare and things like this, if there's an uptick in rhetoric or if it's being discussed with trans men having children or just people who don't necessarily identify as a cis woman. I'm curious as to if this has started becoming apparent in the communities, if y'all have had firsthand experience and how that changes their medical and emotional needs and care through their pregnancies.
That's a great question. What I've seen through my doula training, I've gone through Dona training twice, so I feel like I'm a part of two different generational cohorts of this training. First time around, what you're talking about was not a part of the conversation. There were other things when we get cultural sensitivity, you know, training that we were talking about. So being respectful of people whose households are not a mom and a dad, maybe it's a mom, maybe it's mom and mom, you know, maybe it's another combination. But my second round of training is when we started to talk about the type of language that we use. So you'll notice I definitely slipped into a lot of gendered language. More and more I do try to think in terms of when a person gives birth, when someone has had a child. There are a lot of ways when... a person who does not identify as a cisgender female comes into a space and they are pregnant and they're giving birth. There's a lot that we have to do to make sure that all aspects of the care team are respectful, are asking what pronouns do they prefer, asking what do they need to be respected and supported. And it matters a lot because you're already in a vulnerable space, because I love Linnell's trainings. You know, she talks about how there's a point in birth when you really have got to go inward and you need the safe space to be able to do that. If you don't feel safe in your environment, you can't go into yourself and gather your strength. And so I think a lot more training needs to be done about, you know, what does it look like when there is a set mainstream notion of what it means to be a birthing person and what kind of support needs to be in place? I see a lot of gaps. I've definitely, even as a doula, you know, sought additional training, you know, so that I am respectful of clients who come and, you know, their family structures are different than what I'm familiar with. The way that they identify is something that I need to be educated on. But when we talk about obstetrical violence, we talk about it a lot of times in terms of people having their bodies not respected, not being able to make informed choices. But it also does involve not respecting how people see and express themselves. So I'll let other people weigh in too.
I just wanted to say the trans families that I've worked with are predominantly choosing midwifery care. And I think it's the care of midwives because it's so personalized and so one-on-one. A midwife will spend an hour during a prenatal visit where a obstetrician usually has a few minutes, 6 minutes or maybe a little bit more. So the trans families that I've worked with are mostly working with midwives where the care is highly personalized, and the trans families have maybe already been traumatized by the medical establishment, so they're kind of self-selecting and working with midwives. So that's what I've seen.
I know with the organization I'm with, Mama Sauna Vibrant Woman, we do have birth companion training, and we do have a segment on it. Even when we had the training, it was in April, we had everybody put their pronouns on their name tags. We did have language training as far as breastfeeding or chest feeding. We do use that language now. So I do feel like we're going in the direction. It's just going to take some time.
And as far as policy, I mean, not surprisingly, in conversations about, like, you know, let's just say at the legislature, they're not quite as, like, nuanced or accommodating.
Another question? Wherever the mic, where's the mic? Oh, Amy's got it. There we go.
So just statistically, do you know a difference between the mortality or the harm towards African American women who have midwives versus in a hospital?
So generally speaking, outcomes for American women are more favorable when you have a midwife, and particularly a midwife and doula combination. I don't have the hard stats on the breakdown of how much better it gets for Black women when they have a midwife, but there are a lot of parts and pieces to that. So for instance, if you're with a midwife, you are a lower risk pregnancy to start with. So that's going to improve your outcomes. And I think also it's to exactly what Linnell just described. A midwife is going to give you more personalized care, more in-depth experience. And so anybody who's giving you more attention, all that additional attention, all that additional care and support, it improves your outcomes. So I would like to follow up and give you that stat on how much it improves for Black women. But overall, low-risk pregnancies, you know, fare quite well with midwives. The UK is an excellent example of that. Women in the UK are deferred to midwives if they are not a high-risk pregnancy de facto.
Yeah, and actually in California, that was part of their model. Hospitals started leaning more on midwives. I mean, the way that I remember one obstetrician described it was like, you know, a lot of times when you have especially OB-GYNs or like surgeons, like obstetric surgeons come in, like that is their skill set. They'll kind of try to lean on a cesarean or lean on surgery because like when you're a hammer, everything's a nail kind of. It's not really their fault. It's just that's what they're wheelhouses, but midwives are, first of all, more patient. They're used to long pregnancies, and they're not going to force someone to induce a labor because they're on a time clock. And so California actually saw some great outcomes by leaning on midwives first. And then when, like, you know, it was clear, like, surgery or anything else was necessary that was outside of sort of, like, you know, sort of what was in the wheelhouse of a midwife, they really saw, like, a lot of better outcomes, I guess. Yeah. I don't have the stats, though.
Where are we with midwives in Texas? Like, are they, when I had my first child, midwives weren't even allowed in the hospitals. Are they now, or where
yes,
are we?
Yes, yes. There yeah, are a couple are. Of hospital-based midwifery programs. Midwifery is legally protected, and midwives are licensed in the state of Texas by a board.
We're going to have to do another show on midwifery, I think.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally.
Another question?
All right. Sorry. I think I have two questions. So the first one is, what is there any like hypothesis behind what is causing like the racial difference between people of color, like Black people, white people, and Hispanics? You said are even higher than white people. Like, is there any like hypothesis beside? Is it postnatal care? Is it care during the birth? Or is it prenatal care? Like, what's happening? Is there any hypothesis? Sorry.
Well, Hispanic women in America have better outcomes than white women. And,
the only, believe me, I've looked into this and I've asked, I mean, there's really the only thing is racism. I mean, that's it. I have yet to see any other explanation that is compelling. I mean, maybe you guys have heard something.
It's racism. It's absolutely it's racism. Institutionalized racism. Yeah. And what we were talking about is the weathering effect of racism on the black woman's body.
So the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, has position papers on this. This is a known, accepted source of the problem. They are aware that there are institutional biases that are creating differences in the delivery of care. It doesn't just happen in maternity care. It is across the board in all aspects of healthcare for African Americans. There's a gap in the care that is delivered to us. You also have to think in terms of, just as we've alluded to on the panel tonight, this goes, the disparity in experience in healthcare for blacks in America goes back to the very first days of us arriving in this country. You know, the way that we have been handled, tested upon, and made subjects, you know, of medical care, as opposed to being, you know, fully empowered and respected patients. So, I mean, that's Henrietta Lacks. That's the Tuskegee experiment. That is, you know, the foundation of modern gynecology in this country. So racism doesn't stop at the door of the maternity ward. It flows right on in. And so what I would say, fortunately, it's good that ACOG is aware and, you know, calling it what it is. We do need to see more institutional bias training. We need to see a lot more mechanism put in, you know, for accountability. So we need more feedback from patients. We need safe ways to report, you know, care providers, you know, who commit obstetrical violence or who, have gross, you know, negligence and violations in the care that they are offering. So if we can count it, then we can come up with remedies against it. If there is a penalty for treating people a certain way, then you will check yourself. If you can't do it out of the goodness of the heart, you will do it out of, you know, the pain of the pocket. So that's where we are with that.
I feel like once we see more diversity in the medical field, in the medical staff around, like across the globe, I do see a lot of black kids today who's coming out of college going into the medical field. They're becoming doctors, nurses, and stuff. So once we start seeing that, then maybe we can see an improvement from there. That's just my hypothesis.
So my second question is, this is probably as big a question as, how do we legislate for that? Like, how do we lobby for that going forward? Even if we're not, it's a ground up problem. Like, we don't even have standardized maternity leave. Like, how do we standardize everything else that goes? I thought you might be able to touch on that more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, legislating against racism, I mean, we've never really tried in an effective way, we'll say that. But that's not, I don't think, like, right now public health, like, you know, legislation's going to fix, clearly, because, like, California's an example, I don't think legislation's going to close that gap. I think that is, there is no model right now for closing the racial gap, unfortunately. That is a failure of humanity that I don't, you know, it's like, just put that on the pile of other things that we should be really ashamed of. But, you know, we could legislate to improve access to healthcare for everyone who is low income and doesn't get it through their employer. Expanded Medicaid, that's one thing. I'm not advocating for that, but I'm saying, you know, I'm a journalist, I cannot advocate for that. But I'm saying, like, that is one thing that people could push for. That's a big thing that could help. That, you know, even the Texas Medical Association has said expanding healthcare access would improve outcomes for women. We could, you know, there was a bill that died that would have expanded healthcare to women who just had a baby for up to a year after giving birth. And that would have just been a that would have not been like broken the bank considering all the other things we spend money on here. You know, there are a lot of things that could be done to just improve overall. Now, closing the race gap, I mean, like, I, you know, just because I'm looking for sort of practical, like, real world examples of things that work, there isn't one. So, but there are things you can do in the margins to improve just more people's lives. Like, I think a woman shouldn't have, like, right after giving birth, like, you know, worrying about healthcare seems like a big thing to load on them. Like, you know, it's 3 months after I'm giving birth and now I'm having a health problem. Like, oh man, I wish I would have had it 2 months, you know, after giving birth. Like, that seems like a fixable thing. Now there's just like not the political will, and that, you know, that's something that lawmakers will have to answer for. But I think there's things that could be done in the margins.
And we have time for about two more questions. One right in the back here.
So I think overall we're just saying our healthcare system sucks, which I think everybody here will agree. And I had the pleasure of working with a midwife for 4 of my births at home. It was amazing. And I go out and tell the world and my girlfriends, hey, you should check out doulas and midwives. I feel like legislation is not going to happen anytime soon. So what can we do as a grassroots movement to let people know that these services are available, whether you're black or you're white, and know that these alternative services are available through midwifery and doulas?
So in the Austin area, one of the things that you can do is share information about some of the organizations that are providing these services. You know, on a sliding scale or free. So for instance, GALS, Healing Hands, Community Doula Products.
Say just a little bit more about GALS, because that is a really amazing program.
Yeah. So what a lot of people don't understand is that in Austin, anybody can get an on-call doula to show up at their birth, whether it is in a birthing center or in the hospital. And I don't have the GALS hotline number memorized anymore. I used to, but you can look up Giving Austin Labor Support, you know, bookmark that, share that with, you know, people in your community so that they're aware that you can in fact have someone come and provide you continuous support at your labor, at no cost. And GALS does not ask, you know, what your income level. The idea is that if you are a person in labor and you want support, we will dispatch somebody to come and help you. All GALS birth companions are donor trained. Many of them donor certified. Some of us have multiple certifications of different organizations. If you are eligible for certain social services, you can also get additional prenatal support. There are many GALS doulas who offer postpartum support also. So in this area, you know, you do have access to this type of care at no cost. And so we would like to see more people take advantage of this. You know, a lot of times, you know, most of my GALS births, I was called in by a nurse at the hospital. They had somebody, you know, who they could just tell they needed more support. A lot of people don't understand that a nurse may change shifts during your labor. So as much as you love that one nurse, she may not be there by the time the baby gets there. And so it's great that you have that resource and giving Austin Labor Support. Healing Hands is another service that supports Black women in the prenatal and postpartum period, as well as Mamasana. So there are resources available, like I said, either free on a sliding scale or affordable for women to take for people who are giving birth or have recently had a child. To take advantage of, you know, these support services. So I'll say we are very lucky. We're covered here. You throw a rock, you'll find a doula in Austin.
It's just spreading the word. Yeah, the services are here. Mamasana, we don't even look at income. We don't turn anybody away, even though our organization is for women of color. If somebody that's white come in, we're not turning you away. You're going to get the same service. So the support is out here. It's just we got to share these things.
Right.
Like, how is it working with, say, gynecological organizations in town? You know, how is it working with hospitals? What is the communication system like between doulas and hospitals and doctors and nurses? And
so it varies. And I'll say my experience as a doula, my experience at a given hospital can change within the same birth over the course of that birth. It depends on who cycles in and who cycles out. A lot of women don't understand that even though you select your OB and you're working with them, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the person who's going to be able to be there with you when you have your baby. If they are in surgery with somebody else, you are going to get, you know, the next available person, or if for whatever reason they are not available at that time. So my experience is that there are practices in Austin that are very doula friendly, and even have lists of doulas who they like to work with, and so they may refer. There are practices that are resistant or wary of doulas for different reasons. The same way with different hospitals and different nurses. And so you're always, it's always in flux what the nature of that relationship and that interaction is going to be like. So that's what I've experienced.
Well, we need to kind of wrap things up. But as we do, we promised, what does support look like? So in an idealized world, what does support look like for each of you? How can we really support mamas and babies?
So for me, support looks like education on the front end before somebody becomes pregnant, access to resources while you are pregnant so that you can get prenatal care and support. And it looks like having, in the postpartum period, enough time to heal, gather yourself, and to not feel like there is pressure, ideally, to get back to work, to get back to everything that you were doing pre-baby. You are in a different space post-baby. And so I would hope that you have the medical help, the nutritional help, the physical help, and the financial help in order to, get back to what your new even is going to be.
Linnell?
Ditto. I mean, what you said is perfect,
but I
do want to add on that I asked my 1,100 Facebook friends, what does ideal support look like for mothers and babies? If we're dreaming a new system, let's set the bar high. What is it that we really want? Almost everybody that commented said paid family leave. That is the very first thing that we could implement that would make the lives of mothers so much easier.
I think also on that they said free access to psychological help.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And what do you think, Trisha?
All of that. Plus, how we follow like a midwifery model of care where the mother doesn't have to even get out of bed the first 6 weeks. So that's really something important for me, to just not have to get back to life right after birth. That would be ideal. And just where everybody had access to a doula, whether they don't have any money, whether they do have money, and just kind of building that village back up, that village mentality is something important too. So that's all I have for that.
What do you think, Ashley?
Well, I'll leave it to them because that's like not my wheelhouse. Like, I don't advocate for things, but
you could give us.
I just got the info
piece
on how everything's broken. That's all. That's my wheelhouse. So yeah, they know.
Yes. Yes.
All that.
Well, I just think, having these conversations is so important because we take for granted that our mothers are just taken care of if they can buy the right stroller or, have the perfect outfit or something like this. Like, we really need to get back to these conversations about what support looks like and how to advocate for that. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much to Nicole and Linnell, Trishelle, and Ashley for coming out. Thank you all. And please continue the conversation. Thank you. Have a great night.